Sci-Fi Show Outcast. Welcome to the first Sci-Fi Show Outcast. And the interview I have today is with Seventh Son author J.C. Hutchins. And to give you a taste of the book, here's the first two lines.
The President of the United States is dead. He was murdered in the morning sunlight by a four-year-old boy.
And how could you not be intrigued by an opening line like that? Now, I should warn you, this interview does contain a few spoilers. So listen to the first half dozen chapters if you don't want to be spoiled first. So here's the interview. Well, welcome to the Sci-Fi Show, JC. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, Jason, it's a pleasure to be on. I've been a big fan of your show for a long time, and it's just a treat to be here.
Well, thank you for that. And your book is highly addictive.
Try writing it. You might feel differently.
Well, perhaps, but now I need my next fix. Normally I wait till the books are finished and I've sort of ended up downloading them all before I get around to listening to them.
Sure. Is this one of your first podcast novels or audio books in which following it week to week?
Well, yeah, actually all of the others have finished before I've had a chance to get around to listening to them. So.
Right. Well, at the time of this recording, I think there are 5 chapters left after this one. So.
Okay, I'll cope.
Well, don't worry. It's the first in a trilogy, so you've got 50 more chapters after this, I promise.
Oh, great.
So 50 whole chapters.
So would you like to give us a bit of an overview of the start of the book?
Sure, of course. Seventh Son is a science fiction thriller that takes place in present day. It's about 7 guys living basically anonymous lives all throughout the country. And about 3 weeks after the assassination of the U.S. president, these guys are kidnapped. So these guys are they're brought together to a super-secret government facility in rural Virginia. And we don't know much more about that. But they're all thrown into this the same room. And these 7 strangers kind of look at each other. And despite cosmetic differences and physical differences, I mean, some are fat and some are thin and some are brawny and some are kind of sickly and pale-looking, they all appear to be the same guy, and they all seem to have the same name, variations on John Michael Smith. That's their names. And after comparing notes for a little while, they realize that they don't just look alike. They have the same childhood memories from birth to the age of 14. And this clearly, messes with their heads. And then, some guy in a lab coat walks into the room, and they ask him, why have we been brought here? What's going on? And the guy in the lab coat basically says, well, you've been unwitting participants in a human cloning experiment, and you've been brought together to stop the man who was behind the recent assassination of the U.S. president. Well, who is that? They ask. And then the bombshell is dropped. Well, it's John Michael Smith Alpha. It's the guy you were cloned from, the man whose childhood memories you share.
Thank you for that. And so, JC, I guess the first question is, how much of the technology in the book exists or is based on actual science?
Okay, well, there's none of it.
None of it.
It's all fiction, man.
It's all fiction?
Well, I mean, let's face it. I think that if we're not technologically able to clone humans now, and it seems to be, at least based on my research, it seems to be a very complicated thing to do. If we're not there now, we will be soon. And so the biological cloning of human beings is very near, if not here. I don't know if anyone's acting on it. There's been allegations, and certain groups have claimed responsibility for that in the past, but who knows. The idea of recording human memories and storing them as digital data is... I reckon it's pretty far out in terms of technology, but those are the two core technologies that, at least in the first few chapters of the book, that we're aware of, is the biological cloning of a person, and then this kind of like a memory or emotional cloning. And the whole cool thing about the book is the fact that the memories of a person can be recorded, but then downloaded into the vacant mind of a clone, and that's how we're able to see the seven different clones in the with Severn, who have since lived seven very different lives and have gone on to go into seven different career fields and have seven different distinctive personalities.
Okay. Is there anything to the idea of the memory totality?
Yeah.
Just made that up?
Yeah. I hate to sound... I don't know about other novelists, but I'm a liar. Yeah, this stuff doesn't exist. But there was... I had to concoct a kind of a believable idea for... to me, as a writer, I think that if you're making something up, use some slang or use some jargon to kind of sell it. I mean, if it sounds somewhat official, then people are more inclined to believe it. At least that's how I operate in my mind. And so the idea of the memory totality and the story behind that, according to Seventh Son, the book, there is a region in the brain, and this part of the brain does exist. It's called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is indeed the first place that memory or stimuli go in your mind or in your brain. It's kind of like the way station before they become memories and are distributed throughout your brain and, you know, to become long-term and short-term memories. Well, you know, there are things that we remember and things that we forget. And the problem within the book was, well, I wanted to have every memory and every emotion cloned or recorded. And so I came up with the idea that hippocampus actually preserves or stores all of the stimuli that come into the mind, not just your waking memories, but your emotions and your dreams and all of your subconscious stuff as well. And that it operate, you know, this kind of memory totality or all-term, not short-term or long-term, but all-term memory exists within the hippocampus and, you know, can be detected by a certain, in a special kind of brainwave. And it's this brainwave that can be recorded as digital data. It could be interpreted as the digital equivalent of someone's soul or consciousness.
Okay. And I thought that was a really interesting idea, the idea of downloading someone's mind like that, or probably soul is the right word. It's sort of their complete experience.
Yeah, and I mean, this at least in writing the book, and I hope that in reading it and in listeners kind of enjoying it, you know, the question of what is a soul or what makes us us. I mean, those are kind of some things that I wanted to kind of slyly evoke out of the reader. I mean, this is a very plot-driven, you know, it's a potboiler thriller. I mean, there's make no mistake, but I tried to put some undercurrents of, you know, some philosophical or ethical or bioethical questions in there, including what makes us us, is what makes humans unique. Is it a soul? Is it consciousness? And when one copies a consciousness, in this case, the memories of a boy from the age of, you know, birth to the age of 14, and putting it into someone else, does that mean that that person has a distinct soul, or if they have a soul, is it the soul of the clone, the clonee, I guess, or the cloner? It was those kinds of things that I faced while writing the book that I wanted to ask and pose to the reader during the book itself, during the narrative.
Well, those are certainly questions that occurred to me. I thought it was interesting that the priest, John Michael Smith.
Sure, Father Thomas.
Father Thomas, that's it.
Yeah, there's so many, it's hard to keep track. You need a cheat sheet.
Yes. Upon discovering he's a clone, is convinced he no longer has a soul.
Yeah, he totally freaks out, and deservedly so. And, you know, and each one of these, you know, several of these characters were kind of designed to evoke or represent certain parts of the ethical debate. And in the case of Father Thomas, it was, if I believe that a soul is, you know, divine providence and that we're all unique and we've all been blessed by a unique, one-of-a-kind thing, a magical entity or a divine spiritual entity, and that isn't what is in, that's not what makes the foundations of me, the foundations of Father Thomas is the recordings of a stranger, someone else whose childhood he remembers but never personally physically experienced, which is a true brain bender in and of itself. And so he begins to think that he has no soul because he has been a manufactured thing. Not just that he's a clone. I don't think that the problem is that he has that he's cloned, made up of cloned tissue. It's that his memories are just as manufactured as this microphone in front of me. There's nothing tangible or ethereal about it. Nothing spiritual about it. This really rocks him to the bone, and he believes that his problem is that he thinks that he doesn't, not that he doesn't have a, not that he's damned. It's not that he's damned. It's not that he's going to hell, that he's going to heaven. It's that he doesn't have a ticket to admission, for admission, because he doesn't have a soul, one way,
yeah,
or another.
Hmm. It's an interesting conundrum.
Well, as a listener, particularly you, Jason, I've often been kind of curious how listeners react to that, and I don't want to turn the interview around too much. But how have you reacted to that conundrum? Because coming from a Christian background and kind of approaching these things from a philosophical / a Christian perspective, how did that ring with you?
That's an interesting question. Well, having thought about issues of cloning in the past, which in a sense is just a different version of making twins of someone.
Yes.
Certainly from birth, it seems you'd have two distinct individuals that would have two souls, whatever that means exactly.
Right, sure.
But this case is an interesting one because he shares the memories up to a certain point. I know in some reading I was doing on the question of abortion, it was related to it, what makes someone an individual. And they posted the idea of, because someone was saying, well, you know, until someone reaches the point of being able to be a twin, that they're, you know, they may not be a distinct individual. And they posed the thought experiment that if you had someone that could live to the age of, I think it was 16, and then could split into an identical copy of themselves,
right,
were they not a person prior to that? And it seems like a similar sort of question that you're posing here.
Totally. It's really cool. That's pretty spiffy.
It's sort of like, well, yeah, clearly you still have two individuals, and I don't see why they wouldn't necessarily have souls. I suppose it depends on whether a soul is something you're sort of, when a person's conceived, that's attached, right, to their body or something. I'm not sure if that's the case. I don't know.
Well, I know that that's the Catholic perspective, and that's kind of where I was going with Father Thomas, is that I think that if you sat down and thought about it and you realized that you were a clone, had someone else's recorded memories as your past, and that despite the fact that you think you're 30 years old, you're only actually 14 years old, because the first 16 years of your life doesn't exist, were grown in a jar. I think that most folks, after they kind of, you know, got over the fact that their noodles were thoroughly baked, that they would say, yeah, okay, I've got a clone. I mean, I've got a soul, if they believe in that. But, you know, I guess if you're a Catholic priest in a novel that's all about evoking these kind of questions, you might have a different perspective.
You might have a different opinion, yes.
Right.
I was also interested with the Devlin character and the way...
Oh, sure.
Well, actually, John Alpha does it as well, the way you can download or record someone's mind and then download it into someone else's mind. And
right. Can I tell your listeners about this?
Yeah, that'll be fine. It's interesting how it happens, so just don't go into details of what happens in the actual story.
No, you're right. Of course. Well, the clones learn fairly early on in the story, by the sixth chapter, that during the early years of this human cloning experiment called Project Seventh Son, again, which they were unwitting participants, there were a couple of technological dead ends. The mistake, it was something that they ended up calling Nepth, and Nepth Charge accidentally sends a bioelectrical shockwave through a human mind and erases a person's memories completely. I mean, it's like erasing a chalkboard. And the problem with this is that you can, you know, download the person's memories, a person's memories, back into this vacant brain, but they only live for, you know, a couple of weeks and then they die. Well, John Alpha acquires this dangerous technology and uses it to record a killer's mind into a box, and is able to Nepth charge these victims across the various victims around the world, and erase their minds and replace them with Doug Devlin's mind, and Doug Devlin is the killer. So you've got one mind, an assassin, in dozens of people, and they're kind of, you know, they're disposable assassins. Their time is their body clock is ticking, literally, and they live to kill. And that's kind of the backstory of Devlin and Nepth Charge.
Okay. I do have one question about Doug Devlin. He gets downloaded just before he gets executed. Is there any reason he wasn't re-uploaded and then have everything explained to him and then be downloaded again, or...? I was just wondering about that.
Yeah, it's a perfect question. I think that for the sake... I think it was just it was a decision I made for dramatic purposes, that when he was down... The first time he is re-downloaded into a mind, he doesn't know where he is and he doesn't know the story, and it kind of has to be explained to him. What this did was this allowed me to explain to the reader the procedure and what had happened and what terrible plans they had in store for the world. So I kind of used the debriefing process of one character when he awakens from his Nepth Charge as a way to as an avenue to explain to the reader what was happening.
Fair enough. Like transporters in Star Trek. They move the story along.
Precisely.
It seems it would be strange to be recorded and then downloaded into another body, whether that body would live for 3 weeks or for an indefinite period of time, and then have a conversation with yourself.
Absolutely. Oh, go ahead, Jason. I'm sorry.
I was going to say that really bends my noodle.
Well, imagine having to write it. And I mean, and that was one of the things, that was one of the real joys of writing this particular scene, in which we learn about, you know, not only Doug Devlin's backstory of, you know, his history as a contract killer before he is apprehended and then put on death row, and then finally his consciousness is recorded and then finally downloaded into, you know, hapless victims. It was me sitting down and kind of putting myself in those emotional shoes and looking at, you know, I remember lifting my hands from the keyboard and putting them in front of my face and thinking to myself, what if these very familiar hands weren't familiar at all? What would you do if you were in a brand new body or someone else's body? One that was older or younger or just plain old different, how would you kind of emotionally react to that, and what would you do? And so there's a whole sequence in this particular chapter with Doug Devlin where we kind of learn that he kind of revisited his adolescence in a way, because he was always kind of looking at himself in the mirror, this new strange face, and, you know, kind of looking down at the peculiar moles on the arms or the hands or whatever, because, you know, I think we kind of take for granted just, you know, how omnipresent our hands are or our arms are and how familiar they are to us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was fun to kind of creatively strip that away and ask the question, what would it be like if you were put into a new body?
Okay. I liked the way when Doug Devlin was being executed, he considered himself going on in the box. And whether... Well, there's an interesting question of personal identity there. Who's in the box, and was the Doug Devlin that was executed the same man that's in the box?
That's right. That's right. And that's kind of something that kind of dovetails into who is in the hypercomputer array a quarter mile under the ground at the Seventh Sun facility. Our heroes are... on a tour of, you know, they learn that they're clones, they learn that their memories are shared, and early on in the novel, they're taken on a tour of the facility, and one of the places that they go is this huge underground, basically a big warehouse underground where there are, you know, thousands of supercomputers that, you know, are storing the digital data that is, you know, John Alpha's childhood, which in turn is their childhood. And this really kind of, you know, trips them up and freaks them out. And what is in those boxes? Just like what is in the box contained Doug Devlin. Doug Devlin, as we know it, you know, dies when he is executed in Texas, lethal injection. But Doug Devlin, and that's the question, is Doug Devlin dead because his body in his original site is dead? Or does he still live on, and is that a bona fide entity within that box that's being, you know, that is then being, the contents of which are being downloaded into people across the world. It all just kind of goes back to what is consciousness, what is soul, what is unique about us if that kind of technology becomes real.
Yes, are you identical with your body?
Mm-hmm. Is there a true connection there? Does there have to be?
I was reminded when you were when all of the technology was being described in the book. Have you read Peter Hamilton's Night's Dawn trilogy?
No.
In the Night's Dawn trilogy, they've got a way of uploading a consciousness, sort of like right. The way you do, into a computer, effectively, and living on in the computer. And there's a whole mm-hmm. sort of cult is probably the wrong word, but sort of a cult of people that do this called the Edenites, I think. I can't remember the name. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's
interesting. So, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say the technology was originally developed by one guy a consortium of people that are living for a while, and when their bodies wear out, they upload their minds, kill the old body, and download it into a new body. And from their perspective, they continue to live. But I'm wondering what it's like for the perspective of the body that's left behind. And I mean, I guess it's the same. It's the same circumstance here with Doug.
And that was the mind starts to kind of wander in terms of like none of this is addressed in Seventh Son specifically. You know, there in book two we kind of learn that immortality has been alluded to by that they can be achieved through this technology. And of course, as I was writing the book, I was thinking, well, boy, what if I set a book, 50 years into the future, with this technology kind of being commonplace? And my mind kind of wandered into territory that you're talking about. There's a book by a Canadian science fiction novelist named Robert J. Sawyer, and the name of the book is Mind Scan. And that's a very similar situation where the brain or the recorded into a computer and placed into a robot instead of a human clone. And it kind of explores the same what's in the box, who's in the box, what makes us kind of questions. It's an excellent read. It was kind of changed my perspective on things. It's an excellent book. I read it a couple months ago.
Okay. Well, what was interesting about the Night's Dawn trilogy, which I don't think you've addressed, you haven't addressed in Seventh Son yet, is what was happening was people were coming back from the dead. Souls were coming back from the other side. So if you haven't read it, I definitely recommend it, but it never really resolves the question. But, you've got one character, and when they die, the mind persists in a, it doesn't go to heaven, it sort of goes into, I don't know, the place of the dead, I suppose you'd call it. And yet you've got these people cloning themselves as they go along. And there's this whole... it never got resolved in the book, but you're sort of wondering, are there multiple copies of this person at different points in their lives in the place of the dead while they keep cloning themselves as they go along?
I see. Yes, indeed.
And so I was thinking about that. Well, that was occurring to me as I was listening to your book with all of the Devlins running around and then periodically dying as the bodies wear out after 3 weeks or so. Yeah. And so is there a hell, presumably, populated
happens to these Devlins? And it's kind of interesting because while we never find out, of course, we never follow the soul of a Devlin to either heaven or hell. There is, at the very end of the trilogy, it's about midway through book three, there is kind of, there's a moment where we kind of watch a Devlin die, and how this merciless killer reacts to this is, in my opinion, it's kind of unexpected, but it was pretty cool. It was a cool scene to write.
I look forward to it. Question is, what happens to the person whose mind is overwritten?
Yeah, man.
Because the Devlins seem to have access to some of their memories.
Yes and no. And this is an interesting point that you're probably going to make. because there is something called Nepth Charge, which I've kind of explained. And Nepth Charge, like I said, is like an eraser to it, and nothing before the event of the Nepth Charge can be recalled by the Devlin. When the Devlin is downloaded, it's just the psyche of the Devlin, and the past of the host body is something that he can't recall. Whether or not that host body's mind or soul has been, you know, the implication is that the soul has just been poof, it's been obliterated. It's gone now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene about halfway through book one, maybe in chapter 10 or 9, where someone someone in a position of power is appears to be Nepth charged, but this person in the position of power seems to be able to remember the events of the victim, which is very different than Nepth charge. And that is a plot point that has not been resolved yet in the book.
Okay. Okay. So normally people can't remember the Devlins, or John Alpha can't remember the memories of the person they've overridden.
Yeah, that's the implication, is that there's no recollection. It's just blank.
Yeah, they're gone.
And you got to think about it in the context of the person, you know, the Devlin or whomever is being downloaded into the brain. Well, that's not a problem, because the Devlin can remember his past. Mm. The Devlin can remember his own childhood, but he certainly can't remember the victims.
Okay. Yes, it's a fascinating book. Well, thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure interviewing
Jason.
You.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Like I said, I've been a fan for gosh, going on since January, so half a year now. And just keep up the great work, man. It's excellent. It's a great show.
Thank you for that. And thanks again for joining us. Well, hopefully everybody enjoyed that interview with J.C. Hutchins. And on next time's show, we'll be looking at Star Wars Episode 4 and When Is It Right to Overthrow Your Government? Two last bits of news. I still haven't heard from Raynor about winning the last competition. Hopefully he'll get in touch soon. And I've only had one entry for the new competition, so if you'd like to enter, send me an email with the word competition in the title and include something that might be good as a prize. And it could be general, like a book or a t-shirt, or as the one entry I received, some specific book ideas. Please enter. There haven't been many entries, lots of chances to win. Anyway, talk to you in a week. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Rennie, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.ml.